welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I am joined again by Philip Brining and Joseph Kirk. Full names.
Full names. Again. Don't know what we've done wrong,
I don't know why I like it.
It's probably hello, because Jasmine Harrison.
It's because you were arguing with and having a pop at her during the session. I think that's why we've got Sunday names treatment.
Yeah. it was a good session, wasn't it? We spoke about loads. There's been so much in the news this week.
It's been really good news week, hasn't it? Yeah, loads.
It's good timing for the GDPR radios. It's always nice when it comes flowing in. But let's unpick what we spoke about. So AI speed cameras, possibly the future. I'm not really looking forward to that, but I won't explain why.
Yeah, that sounds scary, isn't it? Well, you know, linking it to back to purpose creep and, you know, the lawful grounds for processing and proportionality. And that was quite an interesting discussion, that was, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, we spoke about the Nicola Bully case, so the ICO aren't taking any further enforcement action on that as well with Lancashire Police.
Yeah, we talked about the potential disappearance of WhatsApp from our shores. I like WhatsApp, do you?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, it's a great tool.
Not for work purposes, but it causes a lot of headaches.
Yeah, you can send images, you can do videos, you can send video messages. It's just great for, I use it for keeping in touch with my kids, you know, it's brilliant for that.
Yeah, it does clog up when they're in the next room.
No, not when they're in the next room. we talked about Eurovision. I thought that your discussion and falling out of the data protection number two bill was great. I thought that was priceless. Comments, Mr. Kirk?
Yeah, so like most GDPR radios, we picked apart a little bit, didn't we, about the data reform bill when Jasmine was sticking up for the Secretary of State for changing the name of the data protection impact assessment to high-risk activity,
assessment of high-risk processing.
Yeah, Jasmine apparently thinks that data protection impact assessment doesn't say what it says it does on the tin, so it needs watering down for people who, like her, didn't quite understand the UK GDPR when she joined DPP.
Now.
You heard this.
It's all right, Jasmine, it's not like 6 months ago, I didn't have a bloody clue either.
I know, exactly. No, there's a lot of terminology in data protection law that I think when you live and breathe it every day, you don't think anything of it and it's just second nature. But I was saying on the podcast in the main session that when I started in data protection, everything just went straight over my head. I was thinking, what is all this like? And these days when I talk to people who don't, you know, who were involved in the organisation but not directly with data protection, it goes over their heads as well. And I explain DPAs to be high, a risk assessment, essentially. And I think
I have to say, this really does quite frustrate me and irritate me to some extent. But this isn't something new, though. You know, the privacy impact assessment was introduced to the UK in 2009 by the ICO. So, you know, they've been around for a long time. You know, they put a D in front of it. It doesn't actually change the nature of what it is, a DPIA. It says it's understandable. And I think that this kind of revelation, oh, heck, have we got data protection law in this country, you know, that people seem to think is the case, you know, after 2018. It's been around since 1984.
I understand what you're saying, but I still don't think that assessment of high risk processing, you know, that is for high risk processing. Privacy impact assessment, what does that cover?
An impact of processing on privacy, and a data protection impact assessment is I like it as a broad title because it's a data, it's an impact assessment of data protection, you know, compliance.
The risk is here where, you know, the individuals or organisations even won't undertake these risk assessments for, you know, what isn't high risk processing. And, you know, it can be best practice to do that in some instances. So maybe that's an issue. But at the end of the day, you know, DPAs, the purpose for them is for high risk processing, and that is now within the name. I just don't think it's an issue.
Well, not always.
Well, I'm confused by what a health and safety impact assessment is. What's one of those?
I wish I knew, if they changed the name. Anyway, we're getting stuck into it again. We'll end up having two sessions. But there's a lot to talk about. And We covered loads in the session. It was a really good conversation. We hope you enjoy the rest of the session, and yeah,
next week it's lawful grounds for proceeding, isn't it?
Yeah, so stay tuned for that one and enjoy the session. Thanks, guys.
And I remember, just kind of as a link to last week, I just remember that we cited some research by the National Cybersecurity Centre that was putting the cost of a data breach. We questioned this, you know, because it was saying it was hundreds of pounds.
Yeah.
So I was interested to see that report in The Guardian that the cyber attack is going to reputedly cost capital up to £20 million. So I just kind of interesting. We did question those National Cybersecurity Centre stats last week, didn't we? But seems more realistic, doesn't it? A big breach like that, you know, 20 mil after clean up and fees and everything else.
I mean, when you're talking about cyber attacks, to me, obviously the reason for doing those, for the, you know, the people that are doing it, is to get money, right? So I don't really know why they'd be doing it to cause small levels of harm to organizations. It would be on a big scale, surely, wouldn't it, more often than not?
Well, I'm not sure they're bothered about how much it's going to cost me in terms of fines. They're just bother about extracting value out of the organisations that they're targeting, aren't they?
Yeah, I suppose so. I meant more in terms of trying to get money off the organisations as opposed to leaking the data. They get paid, they get settled an amount from the organisation.
Yeah. Did you see that the BBC are worried about a cyber attack on Eurovision? That's in Liverpool, isn't it? This Saturday, isn't it, Jasmine?
Yeah.
You going?
Yes. No, I'm not going. I might go tonight to the Eurovision Village. They've got acts on. They've had them on for a couple of weeks now, so go and explore that. But yeah.
Right. Well, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? It's obviously a prominent event, as was the coronation. Just, you know, screens might go blank on Saturday.
Yeah,
is there
a reason as to why they believe that one might be happening? Is a cyber attack something you can predict?
I'm not sure you can predict it, but the reason why they're highlighting the risk is because we're being hosted in Liverpool on behalf of Ukraine this year, isn't it? So they're saying that could be a reason for some bad actors to try and interrupt it or bring it down. And there was an invasion of the stage, I think. Not that much Eurovision aficionado, but Invasion of the Stage in 2017.
Sounds like you are.
I read about.
You were there.
He was the one that ran on the stage, weren't you, Phil?
In the Netherlands. No. What you're saying. Have you noticed any other breaches this week? Sound of a linking over from last week's or not?
Go on, Joe. I'll let you take the lead on that one.
But yeah, I was just going to say, not a breach that's happened, but there's been something in the news about a breach that occurred 6 years ago, maybe seven now, actually, back in 2016. So yeah, 7 years. Uber were targeted in a cyber attack where hackers gained access to 57 million records of Uber customer personal data, including names and phone numbers. I'm sure you're all aware of this breach. It was quite significant. But the chief security officer at Uber was actually found guilty this week of paying hackers £100,000 and obstructing an investigation from the Federal Trade Commission. The US District Judge William Orrick said that Sullivan's steps had succeeded in keeping the stolen data from being exposed. However, prosecutors did originally ask for a 15-month prison sentence. However, it was settled that he must pay a fine of £50,000 and serve 200 hours of community service. The judge, Orrick, also said that he felt former Uber chief executive Travis Kalanick was equally responsible for what he considered a serious offence, and he wondered aloud why Kalanick had not been charged. The judge also said he was influenced by the unprecedented nature of the case, warning that future offenders would be jailed even if they were the Pope.
Oh! Crikey. But talking of that's interesting. So talking of Uber, I noticed that they've been instructed to provide their drivers with some information in privacy notices. So apparently they've kind of not told people about some of the automated decision making that's going on in the background related to their drivers. They have these, I'm not sure how it works, but fraud scores for drivers. And that's automatically calculated, and then people get kicked out of being an Uber driver if they meet, you know, a certain threshold. They say that they have some sort of human intervention, but the judge, I can't remember where it was, at Holland it was, the Netherlands, they said that that just seemed like a sham, you know, symbolic token gesture. Anyway, that they've instructed Uber to make that information available to their drivers. But interesting, they also were talking about the proportionality. Uber then said, "Oh no, it's all secret the way that, that these things work." And the court has ruled that the people's right to that information overrides Uber's right to secrecy. Again, really, really quite interesting stuff.
Yeah, they had a breach last year as well. I remember because that's where I became aware of this breach in 2016, where I think it was like a 17-year-old who had hacked into the system, into the messaging systems like Slack and so on, and they had to shut the systems down. And this 17-year-old was just tormenting with them completely, just for his own fun. But you know, this it just wasn't putting Uber in a good light off the back of this breach, which you know, this prosecutors finally come to a decision with it. So yeah,
when I was actually doing some research on this investigation that's been concluded this week, I actually found out, Jasmine, that the original breach in 2016 was off the back of one that happened in 2014 as well. So serial offences, it seems.
Right, privacy by default and by design.
Yeah, might have to think twice about using Uber.
Talking of capital, we were talking about capital a minute ago, weren't we? They had another breach apparently in April, where somebody doing some kind of just outsourced IT work for them found an absolute chunk of data that had been sat out there for 7 years.
Jesus.
Yeah, unprotected, not password protected, just sat on a server, you know, this Amazon hosted storage. They called it a storage bucket. There's only like 655 gigabytes worth of data, but again, lots of stuff there. So it just shows, doesn't it? You know, and I have to say, when I was working somewhere once, I remember we were looking at moving the website onto new servers, and the old one just got left where it was. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody often, people don't often think about the tidy up. You know, once you've moved a system or done something, you just end up with even test data or real data just left sat on servers, which is still potentially accessible. So shutting down a technical project, you know, shutting things down is equally as important as spinning things up.
Yeah. I see it a lot with, I mean, recently we've had a lot of ROPA projects, records of processing activities, you know, with organisations that have realised that they've needed these in place for the last few years and haven't had anything. And the amount of things that they realise that, you know, that they store, the amount of data that they store without having any awareness of it in the past, it's you know, it brings a lot to light, but it just puts things into perspective, really, you know, how common it is as well for organisations to not know what they've got. It's a bit concerning, really.
Yeah. I saw also, I couldn't really read very much about this, but I saw it in reporting Forbes. And if you subscribe to all these platforms, you have to subscribe to actually read the news stories. It costs you a fortune, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But I noticed that Google are in trouble now again for holding employee applicant data going back as far as 2011. So there was a contractor was assigned some work to work on their Google Hire recruitment system, and when he looked at it, he found that there was, you know, loads of data, resumes, CVs, you know, candidate data, unsuccessful candidates going back as far as, so that's 12 years into 2011. Anyway, he's a contractor, and he's acted as a whistleblower, and he's reported him for dobbed him in for that. So that's kind of over retention. So I can't tell you what's happened as a result of that, but I just noticed that was in the news as well, that you know, there's been controversy. Because what does CIPD have got a recommendation of only holding unsuccessful candidate data for about 6 months? It's quite a short period, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, 12 years is defo too much, isn't it? Definitely.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see, won't we? We'll see what happens with that one.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen any enforcement off the back of retention periods myself. Oh, I don't know about you.
No, there has been. Yeah, there was. My cogs were, and I will come back to you with that one.
Sure. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Did you see in Japan there's this app that they've got where you can download government documents? So I mean, this is a bit bizarre, but what you do is you kind of take your app to a convenience store to print out a government issued document. It's like a P60 or a P11D or something. Anyway, it's been printing out the wrong documents. So Fujitsu, other people's documents. So Fujitsu are in trouble in Japan for that. Like, that's a bit beggars believe, doesn't it? You'd wonder how that kind of issue would arise.
Yeah.
You also wonder why people don't print at home, but anyway.
I know. What have you seen in the news, Joe?
This week I have seen, I tell you what, actually on here, we do bash the ISO a little bit. Maybe that's the wrong word to use. We do bring them up, don't we, a little bit around their enforcement action. And this week, again, it's come out in the news that they're not pressing any, but they're not forcing any action on Lancashire Police for their involvement in the Nicola Bully case. If you remember back in January, Nicola Bully went missing, and Lancashire Police, who had contact with Nicola previous to her disappearance, the police decided to reveal the details of Miss Bully's vulnerabilities to the public, stating why she was high risk. The information disclosed included a statement from the police that Nicola had some significant issues with alcohol, that was off the back of menopause. Police were criticised after disclosing that she suffered from significant issues. And it was reported to, well, it was referred to the watchdog. Well, on Tuesday, it was announced that Lancashire Police will not be facing any enforcement action from the ICO and the Independent Office for Police Conduct. The IOPC Regional Director Catherine Bates said, "Our investigation has identified important learning for the force in relation to the policing role in multi-agency vehicles, which aims to assist the force in their response to similar cases in the future." It added that after a careful review and analysis of all the evidence, it recommended that the force updates its guidance for multi-agency vehicles to ensure all police officers working in this role understand what is expected of them. Further to this, the Information Commission Office were also aware, and they stated that they would provide further details around this decision following the inquest into Nicola Bully's death, which is due to be held in June. So yeah, it's quite an interesting story, that, because obviously the data involved special category, and the instance is quite severe, isn't it? That it was, you know, someone had gone missing and it was considered life threatening.
Yeah, so, it seems strange, you know. Obviously they're not taking any further action, but they're issuing guidance as if they've, you know, done something wrong, as if they've made the wrong decisions and taken the wrong steps. So it seems a little bit contradictory, but
so. You say life-threatening, Joe. Do you mean, are we thinking vital interest as lawful grounds for processing? That's, well, life and death, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, maybe life. Maybe what I said was perhaps wrong, because a vital interest is, you know, that it's life and death, right?
It's life and death. Yeah.
So say, for example, I've got a nut allergy and you don't know that, but Jasmine does. Jasmine's okay to share that because, you know, I've eaten a nut and I'm dying. You know, I'm dying. Whereas Nicola Bully, you weren't actually sure, were you, whether she was dead or not, I guess, or she was to be deceased. So perhaps not, no.
Well, I mean, to be fair, she's gone missing, and you know, it might not be immediate life or death, but still much a concern. I don't know. Yeah,
it's a concern. Can you make an assumption on that?
I don't know. I think we should probably not dwell on it too long.
Yeah, I don't think we have an answer.
But I was just interested in that kind of that. Because you sometimes look at ropers, don't you? Or people who put together, you know, where you've got the lawful basis processing and a roper. And often, it doesn't so much happen now, but when we first started looking at ropers a few years ago, vital interest came up for all sorts of odd things, like health and safety, you know, vital interest. Well, no, it's not vital interest at all. So I think that there was a bit of education required around vital interest, but I think that's possibly moved on now.
Mrs. Lane's put in the chat, it's a good point, to be fair. Appalling, the facts released were of no significance to finding the person. I don't think the public knowing this information would help save her life. Not sure how it would help find her or prevent her death.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah, it's a good point. It's a very good point, actually. Me knowing that information, me knowing that information doesn't mean diddly squat, does it?
No. Lancashire Police's response was that whilst we do have some procedural learning, it's important to note that our attendance was in support of an ambulance deployment and that the officer dealt with Nicola with compassion and empathy, putting her case at the forefront of his decision making on that day, he added.
It's been interesting because, on a slightly related subject, we've had quite a few requests. I've looked at quite a few requests this week that have come to support desk about police requests and solicitors requests and pre-action protocol requests. Yeah, again, so we've been digging over those this week, haven't we, and writing advice notes back to our customers about where we think, you know, they should comply, where we don't think there's sufficient grounds to comply. Interesting, not particularly related, but it's still the police, I suppose.
Yeah, it's weird. I was it was actually really strange. I was talking to our new star manager, Babita, yesterday about the Nicola Bully case. I'll explain what. And then I pulled up, you know, your notes, Joe, and there's her name. So Babita was telling me a story about her old job where she used to work at Every, which is formerly known as Hermes. And she was handling subject access requests and information requests and so on. And she got one from the police under the Investigatory Powers Act for any dash cam evidence or footage potentially of Nicola Bully, you know, to help in their investigation. But she mentioned that this was requested under an a request under the IPA, the Investigatory Powers Act. And according to Babita, there are three grades assigned to IPA requests in which it's mandatory to respond to it, to disclose information. So under grade one, you have to provide information in 24 hours where it's life-threatening. Under grade two, you've got to respond in 48 hours. And under grade three, you've got 10 working days, so 2 weeks to respond. But I wasn't aware. I wasn't aware that, you know, there were police requests, except court orders, really, that were mandatory. You know, I've always been under the impression that in the eyes of the GDPR and Data Protection Act, you know, you can find a lawful basis that will facilitate the disclosure. But it's essentially a choice. And I assume, obviously, that's the case in some instances where it's not under this, but it's just not something that's come under my radar before.
I was going to say that's probably because it's communications data. You know, dash cam footage is probably communications data. And the Investigative Powers Act kind of sets out all sorts of rules that the law enforcement authorities have to stick by when they're doing covert surveillance and things like that. So it's protective of citizens in a way. But it does give them powers to obtain or intercept communications data and make bulk requests for data. So for communications data. So it could well be that, you know, it's just a bit of an odd one because of the nature of Every's business, that it might just same as like the network and information systems regulations. You know, there's requirements in there, but they only affect national infrastructure providers.
Right. So is
Every won't be, but
is personal data not caught by that then? So can they not request personal data through the IPA?
Yeah, because surely that would fall part of, you know, within CCTV footage. I assume that's requested quite often.
I'm not sure if it is. It's a long time since I looked at the Investigative Powers Act, but my memory of it is it's more about restricting what the police, for instance, can do, rather than granting them wide-ranging powers.
Right. Because that was going to be my next question, is that, like you quite rightly said, Phil, we get quite a lot of requests, don't we, from customers who have requests from the police requesting the personal data, and they come to us for advice on what they need to do. And, you know, and as we know, they're under no legal obligation to disclose the personal data. However, the police are well within the right to retain a court order, which would then force the hand of the data controller. My question is if under the IPA they can request this information, why do they not just exercise that right under the IPA in the first instance, as opposed to under the DPA?
Because I don't think the IPA gives them those powers. I think they have to request the data under the... they have to request the data. Well, it doesn't really matter. They're requesting the data. As a controller, then we're obliged to make sure we comply with the GDPR. And therefore, we've got to make sure we're satisfied there's a lawful basis and so on and so forth. So I'll have to reread the IPA because I haven't read it for a long time, actually, probably since it was first enacted in 2016. But I can't remember. But I think even if it did give police powers to request, I think still, you know, you'd have to be satisfied as a controller that it was, you know, proportionate and so on and so forth and lawfully based. And
the rule of thumb is, if not showing, you know,
refuse, and if it's a compelling situation, then the police will go and get a court order, which they know, you know. But there's nothing that, that also says that the police weren't actually wrong in citing the IPA on that request to Every. You know, did they challenge it, or did they just say, yeah, fine, whatever? Because we sometimes see the police do cite the wrong legislation when they're requesting data, don't they?
Yeah.
On their forms, standard quite forms.
Often, to be fair. The 98 Act and whatnot.
Yeah.
We've got a question in the chat from Mrs. Lane. So, I have a SAR for a student via a solicitor naming the parent as a litigation partner. The school thinks the student is GILLIC competent, but not sure whether they should proceed with getting the student's consent in this instance. She thinks we should at least they should at least validate the litigation partner role, but not face this before.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Again, you just, the school's just got to be satisfied that, you know, the solicitor, you know, who they're acting for, and if that individual has got, you know, a legitimate claim to the data, really. You know, if it's a SAR and it's by a student who's got collect competence, then why isn't the student making the SAR? Why is the solicitor making the SAR on behalf of the parent? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, probably have to find out more about the case, to be honest, but.
Yeah, like the age of the student and whatnot as well. I think obviously, you know, it gets it's not really defined, but with, you know, the younger the child, then the more likely the parent can rely on, you know, acting on behalf of the child.
But what this comment reads that there's a request come in from a solicitor that seems to have been triggered by a parent, and the school's not sure whether to ask the child they'll come into this release of the data.
Mm-hmm. I'd assess, you know, the competency of the child.
So why would you not ask for consent? I don't know. I suppose don't know, really. That's the key question, isn't it? What's to be lost by asking for consent?
Okay, so the child's 17. And it relates to litigation for head trauma, but the school feel competent.
Yeah, so it's, they might have a brain injury or something, which means that they might not be full mental capacity to make that judgment as to whether a SAR, you know, even at age 17. So I get that bit, but I'm just wondering why you wouldn't ask for consent from the child unless you thought the child wasn't capable of, you know, processing that information and coming to a rational decision. Mm, I guess it also, if I was me, I'd want to know, you know, we're not supposed to ask, but what's the motive for the SAR? You know, what is it that you actually want? Because, you know, what do you want to use it for? It sounds like it's litigation. Maybe there's a claim against the school for the head injury. Not sure without details.
Emma said they ask for the child's consent if they're 13 or over. And Joe said, in education, we often get form 807s, request for disclosure of personal data to the police under Schedule 2, Part 1, Part 2 of the Data Protection Act, or UK GDPR, Article 61A and 92G. So off the top of my head, I can't remember what 61A is, but 92G is that substantial public interest, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, UK 6.61e is a public task, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Lawful basic processing.
Oh, speaking of which, so Joe and I were talking before about the Keeling schedule for the UK GDPR with the Data Protection Bill, you know, amendments. And under Article 6.1e, there's a new section, EA, for the defined legitimate interest that you can rely on, and then Article 6.1F still has, you know, the basis for legitimate interest. So we were trying to figure out why the defined legitimate interest that, you know, being implemented or could be implemented come under EA rather than F, whether it sits alongside it, replaces it, whether it's related to public task, but then public bodies can't rely on legitimate interests. I couldn't figure it out.
I don't know without looking at it, but I mean, did you see that John Edwards interview? Not interview. Yeah, we interviewed, wasn't he, Joe? Was interviewed about the parliamentary. About the bill, and he was asked about that, wasn't he? He was asked about legit interest. And he, I thought he really waffled. He waffled, I thought, about, because he was saying that it seems to be a perception thing that legitimate interests are too woolly, and therefore he thinks it will benefit us by having categories of legitimate interests as being, in that bill, in the law, written into law, which you just referred to, Jasmine. He thinks it would help and clarify things. But he was pressed on the issue by someone, and I don't think he gave a really clear answer. And my conclusion was there ain't much change in respect of that. It's still open interpretation. It's still for a controller to justify, and the ICO can still challenge that. So I thought it was fairly inconclusive, that actual part of the debate.
Yeah, I actually saw on LinkedIn one of my connections, Nigel Goodin, who works for DPAS. I think some of you may be familiar with Nigel. Kindly summarised key points from the discussion with John Edwards. And he came to the conclusion that the bill could have more clarity around terms such as high-risk activity. He believes there's nothing in the bill that threatens adequacy, which I disagree. That the changes in clarity in the term legitimate interests are important, and that clarity of business circumstances is important to take the doubt out of the system. Does not believe the bill has anything missing, is excited by the ICO's new role and sees the role as a supporter of the empowered citizen, and that the bill presents no challenge to citizens being able to access their rights, including charging them. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I watched the debate and the discussion, or the questioning, wasn't it? It was an interview, really, but by a panel. I got, he's supportive of reforms, the ICA. They're going to put in a board structure, and he said it was a creaking point, didn't he? Which is interesting admission. But, whether the Secretary of State can politicise the ICO and their code of conduct, he said, oh, no, of course not. I think he's wrong on that, personally, but I think the whole system becomes potentially politicised when you start introducing some of the changes in the bill. And my view is that's part of the intention of it.
Do you think he feels a little bit threatened in that if he went against what the Secretary of State was saying, that they try to get rid of the ICO? Yeah.
Well, even if he's got massive standing in the world. Yeah. So if he's I'm off. He'd get a job like that tomorrow, wouldn't he? I mean, we'd employ him for a start.
So let's get him on a podcast first.
Yeah. I can't imagine that he would feel personally threatened by it. But the ICO, they are going to reform it. They need some sort of regulator. There needs to be some sort of regulator, don't there?
Yeah.
I wasn't entirely convinced by the interview. But how do we get onto that? You were talking about those where the things are positioned. I'd have to look at. I can't remember where they are in the bill and why they're where they are, Jasmine.
Yeah, I had a few questions from it that I just kind of spilled out there. But one of them was these defined legitimate interests that will be added to the bill. An exhaustive list or non-exhaustive?
Well, it's going to have to be a non-exhaustive list because they can't legislate for things that aren't invented yet. Different processing activities driven by technology. So it can't be an exhaustive list, and therefore it's got to be broad. He might say marketing is a legitimate interest. Well, all marketing, what about automated profiling and decision making and things like that? That can't be. So I don't know. I think I'm a bit of a, I like the way the system is at the moment. Yes, there is some ambiguity in it, but privileged practitioners, I think, seem to know where they are with it, where they stand with it. But you start introducing other categories, what is a category of processing that's going to be a legitimate interest? It's hard to say, isn't it?
There are some things, to be fair, with the changes that I don't think are so negative. Obviously, we're so used to the way of working, and why fix something that's not broken? But, the changes in the reference to DPAs, from DPAs to assessments of high-risk processing, I don't think that's such a negative thing for, people that don't have, that aren't dealing with data protection day-to-day, that there's a lot to understand and unpick as it is. So it is more self-explanatory, if that makes sense.
I think you're being, I don't know what the word is, but I disagree.
That is the word.
data protection impact assessment, it is what it says it is. I mean, Miles has actually just popped a link in the chat. I've done an article for Miles and DBP on my opinions of of the breakdown of some of the key changes that they've proposed. So if anyone wants to have a read of that, it's in the chat. I'd appreciate that and some feedback. But if I've had some positive response on LinkedIn for it. I disagree with you, Jasmine, to be honest with you.
I mean, fair enough. But I think sometimes we're at risk of forgetting what, you know, what our thoughts were of data protection when we first started to learn about it. We're so used to, you know, we're just very comfortable in what we know now. But when I first started, nothing against data protection people, just data protection in general, it was just like, what is all of this? Like, there's so many terms. It's just like, there's so much to understand. And it does take a while to get your head around things, but then you forget how you got to where you are now. And I think when I talk to customers, say for example me doing the Roper projects with you know, various customers, I'm talking with different departments, and I'm just trying so hard not to use so much terminology, legal terminology, to overface people. So when I explain what a DPIA is, I say that it's a risk assessment, you know, it's an assessment of high risk processing. It's That's where my thoughts were anyway. So take it as daft or not.
it's a fair point, Jasmine, but I think that just stresses the importance of when you are hiring for people to do the role of a data protection officer or a data protection advisor, that you need to have someone in there that has knowledge on data protection.
Yeah, 100%. But at the same time, it is everyone's responsibility within the organisation to have some understanding of data protection. You know, it's not just the DPO or the senior responsible person.
Yeah, I don't like that either. But
really like that one.
You're right. But then it's up to the DPO to train the staff into knowing what a DPIA is. Realistically, it's not that. It might seem a little bit daunting to begin with when you're reading, you know, a whole regulation, but if you strip it back and just look at a DPIA as a whole, you can cover it within an hour or an hour and a half as to what DPIA actually is. Maybe not walking through one, but understanding what the point of a data protection impact assessment is. Mm-hmm. I think you could get across to somebody pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's just one thing though, isn't it? And it's not the rest of the organization's
but we just want the stability. We don't want constant change. And if, you know, the ICO and their code of conduct and guidance is politicized, and it'll change every 4 or 5 years, I mean, it's just ludicrous. We want the stability. We want to know where we stand, you know, right or wrong, I think, you know, good or bad, you know, let's just take it all in the round. You know, the guidance evolve as and the case will evolve over time, and it'll clarify those things. Trying to legislate to try and clarify that, I'm not convinced about it.
I think it was always coming with Brexit though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was an inevitability that how people got hoodwinked. I don't know.
I want to some change.
Happy to go back to this, but I just want to come back to. So Joe has said that they get police requests under schedule. It says here under Schedule 2, Part 1 of the Data Protection Act, and I've seen those ones, and I think they're wrong. I think the police partly the police aren't required to comply with the GDPR, are they? Because the law that regulates law enforcement processing is the Data Protection Act, Part 3. So I think the police should be saying that they're requesting the data for, you know, Section 31 DPA for law enforcement purposes.
Mm.
Yeah, rather than citing the GDPR or Schedule 2. Schedule 2 doesn't apply to them. And then, you know, what we should be doing is thinking, well, if we want to legitimise the processing of that data, criminal conviction data, then it's Schedule 1, not Schedule 2. Schedule 2 is the application of exemptions, isn't it? Schedule 1 is the enablers for special category data and criminal offence data. So I've seen loads of those forms, and they all say the same thing. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'm convinced that the forms are wrong. Mm. I think the police should be citing different bits of the legislation.
Yeah,
I'll have to check it out.
You know, I agree with you, Phil. I've had something come through the support desk that was similar. It was a housing association had a request from the council and requested information of a tenant under that under Schedule 2. I think it was paragraph 3, crime and taxation. I think they're trying to find out some reclaim taxes or something like that. And I had the same standpoint that it's just not relevant.
Yeah, they're citing the wrong bits of the law, I think. You know, they might be what works for them, but they'll just be baffled by the police thing and then referencing the GDPR when it doesn't apply. Did you see that there's a new, moving slightly different, did you see the new AI powered speed camera that is capable of looking at what you're actually doing in your car as well, if you're on the phone or you've got your seatbelt on, and a whole host of different things? That's a bit scary, isn't it?
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think it will actually come in?
It's there. It's ready. It's been created and built by a British company.
It's not approved, though, is it?
No, it's not approved for use, but it's a physical product.
Yeah, but do you think it will get approved for use?
I think so, yeah. I think that what they're saying and selling it is it's capable of doing all this stuff. You don't have to enable all this stuff. But what this, to me, is all about, this is all about purpose limitation, isn't it? So you buy a speed camera for one purpose, and you say it's for road safety, and then you start using it for other purposes. You know, how does that work? Actually, I've never seen a privacy notice on a speed camera to thinking about it. And I think I probably should have done, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
And then it's about what's a lawful basis for processing, that type of information? Is it a legitimate interest? What is it? A public task? What's the proportionality? What issues, people's rights to privacy against the imperative for road safety or for tax collecting or for generating money for beleaguered police forces? Interesting stuff. And if you're making decisions, automated decisions, Joe's got his seatbelt on, but his passenger hasn't, going to prosecute Joe, then I think there's an awful lot in there.
I mean, how can you say that that's proportionate? If the majority of people do comply with the law in terms of speeding and seat belts and phones and so on, then if you're the, where do you draw the line in what these AI cameras are actually collecting and gathering? Surely they can't just look specifically for those things. They don't just check for those. It's got to be everything within the car. I don't know.
I agree. We sat and had a little debate, actually, didn't we, Jasmine, about how invasive that actually could be. Is that if it's collecting an individual on the phone or how many people are in the car, then surely it can pick up more stuff that it's not meant to, outside of criminal offences, for example.
Well, yes. I mean, how could you then hook that up to facial recognition? Presumably you could. It's interesting. I mean, the technology, you cannot stop it, can you? It's just a relentless moving forward, which is fine. It's just got to try, and the law's always kind of trying to catch up with it.
I know, we were saying this. It's AI is going so fast, but exactly like you say, the law's trying to catch up with it. But I feel like, obviously, we see these things coming in, and some of it's exciting, some of it's kind of scary. But as time goes on, and generations move on and everything, if we've not wiped ourselves out by then, it will become more normalized and these things in the future. It's scary to think where the future's going, to be fair, in some ways, even though there is a lot of exciting elements to it. I don't know. I feel like it's just going to, it naturally will get more big brother-esque. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. And we often sit on here, don't we, and talk negatively about AI and the possibilities that could come out of it. But actually, I want to bring a news article to your attention that I saw this week that actually is the good side of AI. And it's an AI-based decoder that can translate brain activity into a continuous stream of text has been developed in a breakthrough that allows a person's thoughts to be read non-invasively for the first time. The decoder could construct speech with uncanny accuracy while people listen to a story or even slightly silently imagined one using only FMR scan data.
Or drive along the M62 and these speed cameras have got it built into them. Oh, that's what they're talking about.
Well, there is that side to it. But I think the whole purpose of it is it's going to be used for people that have suffered from strokes or motor neuron disease that can't communicate.
Right. Okay. Brilliant.
It's amazing that. Yeah.
It really is, isn't it? Yeah. That's the good side of things like the technology these days and AI. So that'll be quite interesting to see. But it sounded quite the testing period sounded quite I don't know what the word is, but the individual had to lie in a scanner for 16 hours each, listening to podcasts, and the decoder was trained to match brain activity to.
I hope they're listening to our podcasts.
Yeah,
definitely part of the brief. Did you see that a Finnish court has imposed a 3-month suspended prison sentence on the director of a company, a chief executive of a company, for negligence over a personal data breach? interesting. So, you know, it's been a couple of years, I think, since the ICO or the courts in the UK have jailed somebody for a data breach, you know, for breach of the law, rather. And that was under the misuse of, you know, Computer Misuse Act. Because there's no overt custodial sentence in the DPA. But I mean, it does say that there are liabilities for directors and officers, doesn't it, in section 198 of the Data Protection Act, but it doesn't specify what they might be. But it's interesting that the Finnish court have imposed a sentence.
What happened? What was it over?
It was a ransomware attack, and they were a health company, and the health data got taken and put on the dark web. And the people prosecuting said that the chief exec's actions were grossly negligent, as he didn't ensure the personal data was adequately protected. So they're blaming him, you know, personally for negligence.
All right.
You know, they said that he should have had basic things like pseudonymization or encryption of patients. None of that was in place. So, you know, it's probably a fair cop, but, you know, it's just interested that it was, you know, suspended, but a custodial sentence.
Mm. No, definitely. You don't see that often. Just going back to the AI topic as well. So EU lawmakers voted yesterday to pass the AI Act. So I just thought that was really, really interesting to raise. I mentioned it briefly, I think it was last week, and probably failed to explain the way it would be laid out, but they're taking a risk-based approach to it. So AI applications will be assessed on whether it grants an unacceptable risk, high risk, or just, you know, little risk. Basically, anything that doesn't fall into those first two categories is generally left largely unregulated, but it's just something to keep an eye on, really.
Interesting to see how that unfolds. What's your thoughts about WhatsApp then, and you know, the trying to break the encryption of their data, you know, so that they that's interesting, isn't it? Because again, they're saying that 98% of their market, it's not just the UK, it's the EU as well, that are saying, you're not happy about this, you know.
Okay.
But they're saying that only 2% of their market is UK based. So it you know, everything I'm reading reads as if WhatsApp is saying, well, if you don't want us to, you know, or allow us to use those technologies to protect people's privacy in the UK, then we'll just withdraw the service, which would be terrible. I think WhatsApp's a great service.
No, I know. I just find it ironic, to be honest. Like, you know, WhatsApp have been under the cosh so much for the privacy concerns, and now it's their privacy measures that are putting them in this situation. It's almost as if they're like too compliant for their own good in this instance, which you never think you'd see with WhatsApp. But yeah, I don't know. It's a bit of a paradox, really, isn't it?
I'm just having a look.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Quick look on the chat. There's quite a long chat there about what's the difference? I don't understand what's the difference.
This is one of the amendments from the Keelan schedule, I think. So Steph's asked, what's the difference between two definitions of pseudonymization? I think the one that was replaced was the original, which says pseudonymization means the processing of personal data in such a manner that personal data can no longer be attributed to a specific data subject without the use of additional information, provided that such additional information is kept separately and is subject to technical and organizational measures to ensure that the personal data are not attributed to an identified or identifiable natural person. That's the first one, bit of a tongue, mouthful. The one that's been replaced with says pseudonymization means the processing of personal data in such a manner that it becomes information relating to a living individual who is only indirectly identifiable, but personal data is only pseudonymized if the additional information needed to identify the individual is kept separately and is subject to technical and organizational measures to ensure personal data is not information relating to an identified or identifiable living individual.
Right. It sounds very similar. I'd have to print it out and read it in a quiet room with a...
Perhaps they're watering it down so people who don't really understand data protection can understand the definitions within there. Like, Jasmine, that might have helped you when you first joined DPP.
It's getting cheeky now.
Just keep it, keep your
natural
gloves.
Natural person, I think. People may be asking, what's a natural person?
So you're right there. So they've changed, obviously, natural. Well, this is another example. So natural person to
individual.
Yeah, it makes sense rather than then having a definition for natural person. It's things like that. That's probably a good move into it.
So we have to explain natural person quite a lot, don't we, in training?
Exactly.
What actually is it, as opposed to a legal person? But
any comments, Joe?
Yeah, moving on. Did you see that Avast? You know, we use Avast, I think, don't we, for our cyber, part of our cybersecurity posture. But they've been fined 13 million euros by the Czech supervisory authority for selling data they're harvesting from people's browsing history, which was a right shocker to me. So that was really odd. You know, so we've got them installed in our system, doing some aspects of cybersecurity. And theoretically, what's happening is it's actually looking at what we're doing and then flogging the data. That's outrageous, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You might have to change provider on that one, Phil.
Well, I'll have to have a chat. They're probably all doing it, Joe, to be fair. But...
So I've got a question that I would like to throw out to the room. Is nationality considered, or could it be considered, special category data? What are your thoughts?
Which room is that room? Are you in?
Who are you in with? Talk to myself quite a lot, to be fair.
Interesting question. What's your conclusion? Are you wanting some input on this? I mean, you know, in some cases, I would have said.
I've got my thoughts, but I want to hear yours.
Well, I would say, like a lot of these things, you know, it depends on different factors. But at one extreme, you've got like British, which could be, you know, anything, you know, that's too. I can't imagine that would reveal any characteristics which could be considered to be special data. But if your nationality was Israeli or Palestinian, then maybe it does infer something around special category data. Type of things.
It's you know, nationality, race, and ethnic origin. They're quite similar. They're closely distinct. Related.
Yeah, they're distinctly different, though, aren't they?
Yeah. But as you say, you know, obviously, if you're from Britain, it's such a multicultural country now that, you know, it doesn't really reveal race or ethnic origin. Whereas I don't know, could you say North Korea or somewhere along those lines, then it's more likely to be able to infer ethnic origin, I'd say, or race, maybe.
I was thinking of religious beliefs or philosophical beliefs as well, you know, for living in certain places, you know.
Yeah, but that, I think that would be a bit too presumptuous, to be fair.
I'm not sure. I think that the answer to, go on, Joe.
I was gonna say, if there was a location in the world where the country is majoritarily, you know, one religion, you could probably infer that, could you not?
Say that again, sorry.
Like Phil was saying about like the religious beliefs, if you know, you take a country that is, you know, very religious and everyone in there, you know, typically is the same religion, could you not infer that that is then you know, that country, the nationality, if you're that nationality, you could infer that their religious beliefs is Muslim, for example.
But you do get, you know, in some countries you get one religion that is much more popular, I don't know, so Islam compared to Christianity, but you still might get Christianity, you might get Hinduism or Buddhism. I don't think you can presume based on where someone's from. You can make assumptions.
There might be some edge cases. But you know, I'm putting these out there, like Israeli or Palestinian, but most cases I would have thought there's just no easy distinction to draw between the two.
Yeah, but it said in the chat, South Sentinel Island would, no one's allowed in or out.
I don't know how he knows that.
We can't have been, otherwise he wouldn't be here, would he? If he can't get in and he can't get out.
So I was thinking, obviously, you know, in and of itself, nationality isn't special category data, but say for health related data or criminal offence data, you know, that where do you draw the line with that? It's not just direct, you know, if you can infer something from it, then it could lead to special category data. Is that the same in this instance?
What made you go down this route of inquiry, Jasmine?
A customer of mine, they're doing the Roper. Honestly, I feel like I'm just in Roper world.
Roper land.
Yeah, Roper land. But
your religion is data protection.
It sounds like a cult. they undertake research and certain individuals that, you know, they share information with, they by law have to check their nationality because there's certain nationalities for which they're not allowed to share research with, because it's not in the interest of the government and the country. So with that, I was trying to determine whether it would count as special category data or could, and I think with the, you know, I came to the conclusion that in and of itself, no, but it depends how they collect the information. So if they were to, you know, have a copy of the passport picture, obviously they collect more information within that, but even still, then it just got me thinking, does it depend on where you're from? Or
I think it's interesting because don't forget the Article 9 actually says, you know, information that reveals the you know, doesn't have to state it, just if it reveals it. So, you know, again, that's a slightly more loose definition, isn't it? The information that reveals ethnic origin or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, it could be that a combination of data might reveal that.
Yeah, I actually asked the ICO's chatbot. And they said not necessarily, but then they pointed me towards some guidance on a website. I just want to read this out to you if I can. So it says, you can often infer an individual's religion or ethnicity with varying degrees of certainty from names or images. For example, many surnames are associated with a particular ethnicity or religion. However, it is inappropriate to treat all such names as special category data in every instance, as this would mean you need a special category condition just to hold such names on a customer database, which is not the case. However, if you process such names specifically because they indicate ethnicity or religion, for example, to target services on this basis, then you are processing special category data.
They say that about other stuff as well, don't they? Like CCTV, you know, the purpose is to... I mean, I was reading something about CCTVs in care homes this morning, and they're saying, you know, it was a legal article, which I thought was really poor, actually. There's a lot of mistakes in it. But they basically, if you put in CCTV specifically to monitor health of a person, then it's special category data, and if you don't, you know, but you just happen to catch somebody in a wheelchair, it's not special category data. Again, this is kind of purpose oriented, isn't it? There was a couple of really interesting developments in the world of SARS, I thought, this week. I read about as well, and I don't know if we've got time to get into them in much detail. What we're talking about next week, by the way,
lawful basis.
Oh, are we right? Okay. So these are two rulings from the European Court of Justice, and one relates to the this notion of providing a copy. I don't know if you've seen this, a notion of providing a copy of the information to the request, the data subjects who've made the request. And the other one was slightly different. That was about, I can't remember what it was about now. It'll come back to me in a second. But this had kind of whether you have to provide a copy or not. Was quite interesting because, you know, people are providing summaries of data in a tabular kind of format. I think we might talk this when we did talk about SARS. That's just quite interesting how they've looked at that and come to some conclusions. And the other one about SARS was there's a German request that went up to the European Court of Justice, and this was about the disclosing categories of recipients or specifically named recipients. And again, the judgment there is that you have to in some cases the actual specific recipients in the request in the subject action request. And they were contrasting that against kind of this generalisation of privacy information where you can have categories, whereas in a SAR, you're meant to be saying, well, actually, you know, the purpose of the SAR is to get information about the processing in order to make some further decisions, potentially like erasure. And if you can't see who the data has been disclosed to, then you can't make that judgment as a data subject, which really means that you need to have really quite accurate records about who's got access to what and, you know, practical implications.
Yeah, with that first case, where they were providing the summary of the disclosable documents, I don't understand why it got to the stage of going to court, why they wouldn't provide, you know, if, so say they received the summary data as part of the fulfilled request, and then they came back and said, no, I want, you know, full copies, redacted or not, but I want full copies so I can see what's what. I don't understand why they wouldn't do that unless it was to save time and resource, except for the fact that they had something, not to hide per se, but, you know, something that could be challenged.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you don't know why. I can't think why they would, you know, don't think that was in the case notes, why mm-hmm. they were providing that. But they were, you know, because basically, if you've got to provide the job is to provide a faithful and intelligible reproduction of all relevant data, whether that's copies or not copies. So it's interesting because what it means is you don't necessarily have to provide redacted documents. You can just provide, you know, a summary of the information providing is, you know, accurate, mm-hmm. faithful and complete. Is there more work in doing that? You know, extracting the various items of personal data into another format rather than redacting stuff? I don't know, but...
But I was always under the impression that, you know, a summary would be... Until this, that a summary would be sufficient, you know, as long as they do provide the, you know, everything that the individual is entitled to. I guess with this, you know, you can't guarantee that if it is a summary, but, you know, we provide transcripts of calls and so on.
Yeah, you have to have faith in the data controller having done the job diligently and properly, wouldn't you? With this whole which is, you know, the whole essence of the GDPR is you've got to rely on controllers to do the right thing, isn't it? But again, that was quite interesting. Maybe we'll have a read of that and get into that next week. Have a chat about it. There's quite a lot of other stuff that I saw in the news. It's quite a good week for news this one, wasn't it? I mean, stuff about compensation, stuff about accountability principle. Oh, that case that you mentioned about retention. There was a case, Joe, and it was one we talked about a while ago. It's a German case, and they got fined €14 million or something like that for over-retaining data. And that actually has been back through the courts again. We've probably run out of time, but I'll flick it on to you now. Look at that, because that is definitely a fine that was levied for basis of data retention.
Yeah, please do. That'd be an interesting read.
Yeah.
Well, with 1 minute to go, I've got probably the most important and biggest news piece of them all. I was looking through some news articles and this came up and I thought, you know what, I'll chuck it in. So a woman has sparked debate online after expressing her contempt towards her neighbours as their children's new trampoline means she has no privacy in her own home. The woman is tired of multiple kids seeing straight into her home. Writing on the popular forum site Mumsnet, she said, "They can see straight into my house, so I'm in the kitchen or trying to have dinner or just relaxing on the couch and the kids are bouncing and trying to get attention or wave and just constantly staring in." She continued, "I know they're only kids and they're only having a bit of fun, but it's really annoying and now I feel like I have no privacy." So I wonder if she can logically complain to the ICO or something in that instance.
Very good. So we're doing what next week, did you say? Lawful grounds for processing, lawful processing.
Yeah. Beyond consent it is. So yeah, we'll unpack what lawful basis you know, applicable where and what common misconceptions there are and all sorts. If anyone's got any questions, bring them along.
But there's something on that we haven't had time to talk about today, but something about an Austrian court has ruled on cookie paywalls, where, you know, if you don't want the cookies, you've got to pay to access the service. If you accept the cookies, then you can have the service for free. That again is going to come, I think we should talk about that next week. You know, is that, you know, freely given consent? Is it, you know, leveraged? You know, is that permissible? You know, what's going to happen to that one? That's an interesting decision.
It
I know
is.
That a lot of the EU stuff doesn't apply, but, you know, it still does, doesn't it? Still, you know, a lot of it is still, the European Data Protection Board's opinions are still rooted in sound legal logic.
Yes, well, the consent definition is the same, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right,
and we'll end on a joke with...
I'm off to South Central Island this week. I've got a weekend away.
Let them know when you're all up
there.
Yeah. Steph said in the chat here, "I replaced our bed with a trampoline. My wife hit the roof." And on that note, we will end today's session.
Very good.
Thanks for that, Steph. And thank you, everyone, for joining. I hope you all have a great weekend, and we will see you next week for Beyond Consent Lawful Bases.
Perfect. Thank you, Jasmine. Thank you all. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.